Good morning.
Good morning.
I am glad that Brother David B. is back this morning because he has a fine appreciation for irony. I'm about to talk to you for the next 20, 30 minutes or so about silence. Part of that is his dad's fault, because Mr. Woodford and I have discussed silence in worship service before, and perhaps the implications of silence. And I will tell you quite frankly that when I began this study, I had no idea how huge it was biblically as a topic. I've been in the church my whole life, and I've never taught a sermon or heard a sermon on silence. And as a topic, it was huge. And I did not realize how much I had tried to bite off with this sermon. There are lots of different kinds of silence that we hear of in the Bible. And what we're going to do first is we're going to take a brief survey of some of the silences that we read of in the Bible. The first one takes place in Exodus chapter 14. In Exodus chapter 14, what you have is Moses with the people of Israel. They've just come out of Egypt. They're being led by a cloud, which is God's manifestation to the people. They're following the cloud. The cloud leads them to the edge of the Red Sea. And they're standing there gathering up, looking at the Red Sea, and finally somebody turns around and says, "Hey, look, Pharaoh and his army is coming." And like a early Paul Revere, he apparently runs through the crowd towards Moses, screaming, "The Egyptians are coming! The Egyptians are coming!" which creates a panic. And immediately the elders of the Israelites come to Moses and said, "Dude, did you really bring us out here to die? This was just silly. We were slaves in Egypt, but at least we were alive." Look in verse 14 of Exodus chapter 14. Moses says to them, "The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." What does that mean? Be quiet. Just watch. Most of us know the rest of that story. The Red Sea opens. The Israelites walk through on dry ground. The Israelites didn't need to say anything. They didn't need to do anything. All they need to do is be quiet and watch God. Silence is frequently a response to sorrow. In Leviticus chapter 10, we read about Aaron's silence. And it is a profound silence. But it is a silence imposed by God. Nadab and Abihu, his two sons, brought a strange fire. Now what this means is, God lit the fire on the main altar, the sacrificial altar, and he said, "Y'all need to get the fire from there to go light the incense in the holy place." Well, Nadab and Abihu may have been taken more than they should have of the wine, and they brought fire that they got from someplace else. And God struck them dead because they didn't mind. And God told Moses, "You need to go talk to Aaron, because there are several things Aaron better not do. He better not cry. He better not go touch those bodies because they're unclean, and he is the high priest. He better not be unclean. He needs to keep his mouth shut and move on, because the sentence was mine." And what it tells you is that Aaron kept silent. He obeyed God. But one cannot think that in his silence he was not deeply grieved by the death of two sons. The next silence in terms of sorrow that we read about is found in the book of Job. Job chapter 2, starting in verse 13. Job's friends come to visit him. He has lost everything: his wealth, his children, his flocks, his bodily health. Look at verse 13, and it says, "For 7 days and seven nights no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great." And we read that very quickly. And we move on with the rest of the story, and we find out that after 7 days are over, they open their mouths. And that's where they get themselves in trouble, quite frankly. And it even they go so far running their mouths that it angers God. But for 7 days, they sit with Job and say nothing. There is a great deal of comfort in presence. After they open their mouths, Job's not taking much comfort from these friends who showed up, quite frankly, because they're not very nice. But you have to know that for 7 days, he is comforted by their presence, because they're there with him. Everybody else has left him, and these guys are with him. The silence is profound. Can you imagine sitting with somebody for 7 days and not saying a word? I've never done that. I've sat with somebody for an hour, sometimes a couple hours, 7 days. I've never done that. It's an impressive amount of time to sit there and be company to somebody who is so distressed that nobody can think of anything that needs to be said. This is a random picture of nature, and there are so many pictures that I could have chosen. The scriptures abound with references to God's handiwork and what we learn from God's creation. In Psalms chapter 107, he says, he makes the storm calm so that the waves are still, and he brings them that go to the sea to their desired haven. The Lord is made known through his works. All we have to do is take the time to go look at them. Recently, one of the hobbies that I have decided to invest some time in is hunting. I am amazed at the number of hunters that I have met who are quite willing to profess a profound admiration for God's work. Hunters, just by the very nature of the hobby, spend a lot of time in nature, looking at God's creation in silence. You make noise, you scare critters away, so you sit there in silence. You have a lot of time to contemplate. I have yet to meet a hunter doesn't believe in God. It is an interesting phenomenon. I have no doubt that there are some of them out there. I haven't met that in person yet. What you see here is a photograph of Mount Horeb. Mount Horeb apparently seems to be in some dispute as to which one it actually is. This is one of the mountains in Israel that people believe might be Mount Horeb. Now, why is Mount Horeb interesting? Well, because Elijah went there. Elijah went there after he had been on Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel is the more famous of the two because there was a fairly large contest that happened on Mount Carmel. You might recall that Elijah goes there with about 450 prophets of Baal, and he says, y'all build an altar, I'm going to build an altar, and we'll see which God is actually God. Elijah spends a lot of time making fun of these 450 guys. Finally, the Lord lights Elijah's altar on fire, burns his entire sacrifice, the altar, the stones, the water, all of it, and 450 prophets of Baal die. Now, Ahab, who is a wicked king, and Elijah go home. Ahab goes home to his wife Jezebel, who is an evil woman, and Jezebel sends a message to Elijah that says, if you're not dead tomorrow, it won't be because I didn't try. And Elijah, that's a paraphrase. Elijah runs, and where he goes is to Mount Horeb. He goes to a cave here. God comes to him and says, what you doing here? And Elijah, again, I'm paraphrasing. Elijah says, Lord, I'm the only one left. To which God replies, "You are confused. Go to the mouth of this cave." Now, if you look in 1 Kings, starting in chapter 19, you will read the entirety of this story. I want, however, to focus on verses 5 through 7. Because God says, "I want to show you me." And there's a strong wind that comes by. But Elijah knows that God is not in the strong wind. There is an earthquake that comes by, but Elijah knows that God is not in the earthquake. There is a fire that rushes the mountain, and Elijah knows that God is not in the fire. But what comes last depends on the translation that you have. Some of the translations say that there's a gentle breeze. Some of the translations say a still, small voice. And some of the translations say a thin sound of silence. Do you have to talk to show somebody that you love them? I would dare say not. Think about the last time your mother touched your face. Didn't have to say anything. That's what God is doing for Elijah. In complete silence. There are times when man is just awed with the mightiness of God himself. What you see here is a representation of Solomon's dedication of his temple to the Lord. And really what I want you to look at here is all those people behind him. We've talked about Solomon's posture, the hands raised to God, but really I want you to look at those people behind him. Solomon talks for more than 8 hours. What are those people behind him doing? They're quiet. God's presence has filled this temple, and they know they're in the presence of God. God's silence is not always comforting. Sometimes God's silence is given as a punishment. If you look in Deuteronomy chapter 31, what you will find is that the people of Israel are coming down the home stretch. They are almost to the land of Canaan. And God is talking to Moses and said, "I've got something else you need to tell these people. Eventually these people are going to forget from whence their blessings come. They're going to start following idols. They're going to forget me, and they're going to think that these wooden idols that they created with their own hands bless them." Look in verse 17 of chapter 31 of Deuteronomy. God says, when that happens, not if, by the way, he says, when that happens, "I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them." It happens. All of Israel gets taken into captivity, some of them into Assyria, some of them into Babylon, and it is a direct result of their idolatry. If you look in Malachi chapter 4 and look at verses 5 and 6, this is the closing of the Old Testament. This is where 400 years of silence starts. The Old Testament ends with, "See, I will send the prophet Elijah to you before that great and dreadful day of the Lord comes, and he will turn the hearts of the parents to their children and the hearts of the children to their parents, or else I will come and strike the land with total destruction." This is the last thing God has to say for 400 years. And it is as a direct result of the punishment that he lays upon them. When 400 years is done, we open in the book of Luke chapter 1. How do you break 400 years worth of silence? Look in Luke chapter 1 with me, please. It's a relatively long reading. I'm going to start in verse 8. Once when Zechariah's division was on duty and he was serving as priest before God, he was chosen by lot according to the custom of the priesthood to go into the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And when the time for the burning of incense came, all the assembled worshippers were praying outside. Then an angel of the Lord appeared to him standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was startled and gripped with fear. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, your prayer has been heard." Okay. Remember earlier we were talking about Leviticus chapter 10? Nadab and Abihu, they're dead because they did this job wrong. Zechariah went in to the holy place, which is right next to the Holy of Holies, with some fear and trepidation to start with. He already knows that God considers this job an important one, and you need to do it right. Nadab and Abihu dropped dead doing this job wrong. 400 years of silence. This angel shows up to Zechariah in the holy place. "Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you are to call him John. He will be a joy and delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth. For he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He is never to take wine or other fermented drink, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before he is born." And that's borne out because we know that when Mary goes to visit Elizabeth, that John leaps within her womb. "He will bring back many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God, and he will go on before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of their parents to their children and the disobedience to the wisdom of the righteous, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord." Does that sound a lot like Malachi? Zechariah knew this. 400 years of silence has ended, and what is Zechariah's response? Zechariah asked the angel, "How can I be sure?" Now you have to understand that we get to read this as text, and frequently we read this as a monotone. But this was a conversation. Every time I read this conversation, the voice that I hear next is annoyance at best, perhaps anger. He says, "I'm an old man and my wife is along in years." And the angel said to him, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God. I have been sent to speak to you and tell you this good news." Holy cow, whatever do you want? You want another sign? By the way, the thing wrong with this picture is the angel. If you go back and look at the book of Daniel, you'll see a much better description of what angels look like. They were pretty freaky looking beings. And there was a reason that Zechariah was afraid, but this was the best picture I could find. There's this creature standing in the holy place where if anybody else goes, that person is dead. Zechariah says, "Give me a sign." Gabriel's like, "I came from the right hand of God to give you good news, and you want a sign?" Let's keep reading. "And now, you will be silent and not able to speak until the day this happens, because you did not believe my words, which will come true at the appointed time." He's not talking anymore. Not because he doesn't want to. Meanwhile, the people are wondering why Zechariah is waiting so long. And when he came out, he couldn't speak. They realized he had seen a vision. He kept making signs, but remained unable to speak. When his time of service was completed, he returned home. Now, this is one of the things I wasn't able to find. I don't know how much longer his term of service was after this. However, Elizabeth is not pregnant at this time. He's silent through the rest of his service. After this, he went home, and after they went home, Elizabeth became pregnant. We don't know how long that span of time was that he was quiet before Elizabeth got pregnant. But you know he spent at least 9 months silent. whatever time before, we know at least 8 days after the child is born. Skip down to verse 57. When it was time for Elizabeth to have her baby, she gave birth to a son. The neighbors and relatives heard that the Lord had shown her mercy, and they shared her joy. And on the eighth day, they came to circumcise the child, and they were going to name him after his father Zechariah. But his mother spoke up and said, no, he's going to be called John. And they said to her, there's no one among your relatives who has that name. And they made signs to the father to find out what he would like to name the child, and he asked for a tablet. And to everyone's astonishment, he wrote, his name is John. And immediately his mouth was opened. He's had a long time to contemplate this moment. Angel told him, the boy's name is John. Oh, now you're going to believe what the angel had to say. Do you suppose during that 9+ months that he contemplated that conversation in the temple a lot? I do. He had a long time to contemplate. What could I have said better? What could I not have said? And immediately his mouth was opened and his tongue was free and he began to speak, praising God. You know what? While his wife was pregnant, his mouth being shut was probably a blessing to her, quite frankly. It might have been a blessing to him too. 9+ months he got to think. Yes, he had a tablet, but most of y'all that know, you know, who have done that, it's slow going, talking, communicating like that. 9 months he got to be quiet. 9 months he got to think about the words of that angel and contemplate them. And then we get to our scripture reading from this morning that was ably read to us by Brother Samuel. Turn to John chapter 8, please. Jesus goes to the Mount of Olives. It's early in the morning. Group of people is gathered around because they want to hear what he has to say. Then it says, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. We don't know how many people this is. It's a group. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, they are clearly ignoring her other than the fact that she's here. They're pointing at her. They have no intention of her speaking at all. She is silent, standing in front of two groups. One, the group of people who showed up to hear Jesus, and the other, the group of people who brought her to Jesus. By the way, the people who came in and interrupted were being rude by anybody's standards. In the law, it commanded us to stone this woman. Now, what do you say? Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. I have heard entire sermons about what he wrote on the ground. You'll notice that the Bible is silent about what he wrote on the ground. Let's stay that way and move on. What we know is that Jesus didn't talk to him. He was silent before his questioners. Now, we know that the Pharisees and the teachers of the law could see whatever it was that he wrote on the ground. But they got impatient. And they kept questioning him. He straightened up and said to them, let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. And he stooped down and wrote on the ground again, which means he was silent again. Y'all think about it. I'm done talking with you. Y'all think about it. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time. The older ones first, until only Jesus was left. You got a group of people who are already hot around the collar, drag this woman in front of Jesus. Angry people don't usually give up really easily. We don't know how long this period of silence lasted because we don't know how big this group was. But if they left one at a time as they faded out, we're guessing it took a while. Meanwhile, the woman's not speaking. Jesus isn't speaking. The accusers aren't speaking. You have a lot of drawn-out silence, which is pretty awkward for most of them. And finally, Jesus was left with only the woman standing there. And he said, woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you? No one, sir. This is the first time this poor woman has been able to speak. There's nobody left here to throw rocks at her. Jesus has just functionally saved her life, in a very literal sense of that word. Jesus says, neither do I condemn you. Go now and leave your life of sin. How many mini lectures might she have gotten? How many words of advice might he have offered? I don't condemn you. Go and leave your life of sin. And we don't hear anything else to this woman. What did the silence teach her? I dare say it taught her quite a bit. And I'm sorry I'm going long-winded this morning. All right. Jesus practiced solitude and silence a lot. I'm going to skim through a lot of this. I'm sorry that, as I said, this was a huge chunk of stuff that I came upon when I started this lesson. If you look in Mark chapter 1, what you see is Jesus going out to the desert for 40 days after he had received the Spirit. He was alone there until Satan came. He spent 40 days in near silence. If you look in Mark chapter 1, verse 35, it says, early in the morning while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, went to a solitary place where he prayed. Luke chapter 5, Luke chapter 6, Luke chapter 11, Matthew 14. All of these are times when Jesus goes to a place of silence so that he can pray. If Jesus felt the need to go find places of silence, surely there's a clear implication to us. I spent a weekend not too long ago in a hunting cabin with four teenage boys, and it was a fascinating thing to behold. Four teenage boys who all had iPhones, who would sit within 3 feet of one another, nobody saying a word, but all of them plugged in. And I don't think during the entire weekend that they had those things out of their ears. For me, one of the great joys of going out into the woods is my phone doesn't have any connectivity out there. I'm not bothered by that at all. That's one of the reasons I go out there. And these young men were filling their ears the entire time with whatever, and they missed the silence of the woods. Jesus frequently called his disciples to join him in solitude. If you look in Mark chapter 6, he said, because so many people, I'm starting in verse 31, because so many people were coming and going, they didn't even have time to eat. And Jesus said to his disciples, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. And so they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. Silence is useful. It allows you to think. It allows you to listen to whatever it is that God has to say to your heart. If you've always got input coming in from some other source, it's hard to hear God. Well, okay, I'm trying to pare this down. Believe it or not, I actually managed this in half an hour last night, but it's not working. Silence as a condition for tranquility. If you look in Philippians 4, verse 4, what it says is, rejoice in the Lord always, and I will say it again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all, for the Lord is near. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. And finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Whatever you have learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put it into practice, and the God of peace will be with you. Right, pure, lovely, true, noble. Those are much easier to see when you're surrounded by God's blessings, when you have the time to appreciate them. And you know what? We have very busy lives. You have to make the time to appreciate them. God says, be still and know that I am God. Silence before the Lord is not a luxury. It is a necessity. Christianity is a fairly quiet revolution. Like flowers and grain, truth and love grow when they are nourished. Zechariah says, "Be still before the Lord, all mankind, because he has roused himself from his holy dwelling." Isaiah chapter 30 says, "For thus says the Lord God, the Holy One of Israel, in returning and rest you will be saved. In quietness and in trust shall be your strength." Are you ready to listen to the Lord of glory? Has God already spoken something to you and you need to either confess that to us or you have some desire to be baptized? We have people here this morning who can help you, who will pray with you, who will pray for you. If you would like to do that as we stand and as we sing.